the alleged gassings and cyclone. One must agree that gassing with carbon monoxide is inefficient. The source of the carbon monoxide was supposed to have been the exhausts of a diesel engine at Belzec, and of captured Russian tanks and trucks at Treblinka. One must also agree that Cyclone B was more efficient because it consisted of crystals which, when exposed to air, sublimated into prussic acid, hydrogen cyanide gas. There was no deadlier gas and, in fact, Cyclone was a well-known and widely used insecticide developed by the Deutsche Gesellschaft für Schädlingsbekämpfung, DGSH, German pest control company. It had been marketed worldwide before the war as an insecticide. The word Cyclone means cyclone, meaning the product was a cyclone for pests. It was used throughout the German armed forces and camp system during the war, and it was thus used as an insecticide at Auschwitz. The ordering and receiving of Cyclone at Auschwitz was done by the so-called Referat für Schädlingsbekämpfung, pest control office. The constant menace of typhus as carried by lice has been noted, and the calamitous results of a complete breakdown of disinfestation measures at Belsen have been seen. In view of the particular hospitability of the Auschwitz-Katowice operations to the typhus-bearing louse, in view of the fact of epidemics at Auschwitz that actually forced work stoppages, and in view of the tremendous importance of the Auschwitz industry to the German war effort, it is not surprising that Cyclone was used in liberal quantities at Auschwitz and in the surrounding regions, for its intended purpose. It is this chemical product, known to be an insecticide and known to be used at Auschwitz as an insecticide, which, in the WRB report but starting even earlier, was claimed and continues to this day to be claimed, as the source of the gas used to exterminate Jews at Auschwitz. It is not correct to say that the insecticide role of Cyclone has been concealed. The WRB report mentions the anti-parasite role of Cyclone, and a dual role for Cyclone at Auschwitz is explicitly claimed in the IMT transcript. We must be careful at this point to note the significance of the legend's Cyclone B allegation. Here we have, on a major point, the main attribute of a hoax, as we begin to examine the details of the Auschwitz extermination claims, the fact requiring a dual interpretation. This is not discussed or, apparently, even appreciated in the final solution literature. Hilberg merely utters the completely irrelevant assertion that, quote, very little was used for fumigation, unquote, and then cites unconvincing authority. Reitlinger does know better. The most typical use of Cyclone was in disinfestation rooms and barracks. Everything was sealed, and then the necessary amount of Cyclone, which came in green cans, was emptied in, figures 27 and 28 in the print and ebook editions of this book. After the proper time interval, it was assumed that all the lice and other insects and pests were dead, and the enclosure was aired out. Cyclone could be used for disinfesting clothing by employing an extermination chamber. Such were marketed by the German quote-unquote extermination industry, although at that time, steam baths were also used for the disinfesting of clothing, especially at permanent installations. The extermination chambers were preferred in connection with highly mobile or special conditions. The U.S. Army, which also had insect control problems during the war, had correspondingly similar devices, and had devised a quote-unquote field chamber. Because the U.S. came into the war late, it had time to adopt the newly developed chemical DDT for the functions that Cyclone performed for the Germans. Naturally, the Americans employed DDT in their camps, concentration or otherwise. As a more advanced insecticide, DDT was more versatile for various reasons. For example, it was not nearly as lethal for human beings as Cyclone, which was quite lethal, and in its commercial form contained a quote-unquote warning stuff, an irritant that was noticed much easier than the almost odorless cyanide gas. It is common to leave out frills in military versions of products, and thus the irritant was absent from that Cyclone employed in concentration camps. The dual role of Cyclone was asserted at the IMT on January 28, 1946, in the testimony of a witness called by French prosecutor Dubost. On January 30, Dubost submitted as evidence document 1553 PS, consisting of a number of invoices from DGSH, addressed to SS First Lieutenant Kurt Gerstein, for various quantities of Cyclone sent to Oranienburg and to Auschwitz, plus a lengthy quote-unquote statement attributed to Gerstein. After some hesitation over certain legal technicalities, both parts of the document were accepted in evidence, notwithstanding the claims of Rassinier and Reitlinger to the contrary that the statement was rejected. Two invoices are printed in the IMT volumes, and part of the statement is printed in one of the NMT volumes. The invoice samples printed in the IMT volumes include one invoice for 195 kilograms of Cyclone sent to Oranienburg, and one for the same sent to Auschwitz. It is probable that the Oranienburg Cyclone was ultimately destined for other camps, and that Cyclone sent to Auschwitz was to be shared with all the smaller camps of the region and possibly also with the coal mines. The case of Kurt Gerstein shows that there is no limit to the absurdities that intelligent people can attain, once they have accepted falsehood as truth. This is the same Gerstein who appears as a major character in Rolf Hochhut's play, The Deputy. Gerstein's title in the SS was Chief Disinfestation Officer in the Office of the Hygienic Chief of the Waffen-SS, and as such it was his responsibility to supervise the deliveries of disinfestation supplies to all the camps administered by the SS. Two versions of what happened to him at the end of the war are offered. In the one, he encountered American interrogators by chance in a hotel in Rottweil, Black Forest, to whom he related that he had obtained a responsible post in the Nazi Party, while operating as a secret agent for the sometimes anti-Nazi Reverend Niemöller, that he had been involved in operating gas chambers, and that he was prepared to act as a witness in any court. He handed them a 7-page document, typed in French, together with a note in English and some Soclone invoices, and then vanished. In the other, he somehow found himself in Cher Schmitty military prison in Paris, composed a document in his own hand in French, added that Soclone invoices, and then hanged himself in July 1945. In either case, neither he nor his body has ever been found. He vanished, allegedly leaving a quote-unquote statement and some Soclone invoices that became document 1553 PS. The former version of the Gerstein story is the one claimed in the descriptive material accompanying the document. Even if we were not presented with such an obviously fishy story concerning Gerstein, we would doubt the authenticity of the statement merely on the grounds of its contents, for it is ridiculous in the story it presents, for example that Gerstein took his position in the SS in order to attempt to sabotage the exterminations, quote, a man who had penetrated hell, with the sole intention of bearing witness before the world and aiding the victims, unquote. The text of the statement, including the part published by the NMT, is included here as Appendix A. The statement plays no great role in the analysis, but the reader should examine it sometime. It is absolutely insane. It is no marvel that people who can take this story seriously have remarked on the quote-unquote ambiguity of good and feel, quote, a certain malaise, an inability to arrive at a full explanation of Gerstein as a person, unquote. The Deputy opens with Gerstein forcing his way into the reception room of the papal legation on the Rockstrasse in Berlin, breathlessly relating the story of his statement to the papal nuncio. It is thoroughly unforgivable that Hilberg and Reitlinger use such an obviously spurious statement as a source, and without apology. Reitlinger, however, points out that Hitler never visited Lublin, as the statement asserts. De Gesch was not the only firm involved in the quote-unquote extermination business. The firm of Tesch and Stabenow supplied customers with Soclone and also with equipment for extermination chambers that were of typical volume, 10 cubic meters and smaller. On page 71 of the print edition of this book, we saw that there apparently existed such gas chambers at Dachau which were, of course, represented as murder chambers in the early phases of the propaganda, although today no attempt is made to claim they are anything other than disinfestation chambers. Tesch and Weinbacher, officers of the firm of Tesch and Stabenow, who had sold some extermination chamber equipment to the camp at Grossrosen, were hanged for their role in the extermination business, their plea that they did not know that their merchandise was to be used for purposes other than disinfestation, and their alternate plea that an order of the SS could not be refused, having been rejected by the British military court. Lines of authority. Paragraph 7. According to affidavits given by Huss and Friedrich Entress in 1947, the first gas chambers put into operation in the summer of 1942, now contradicting the affidavit of 1946, were makeshift affairs consisting of two old peasant houses made airtight, with windows sealed up. At the Auschwitz trial in 1963-1965, it was held that the bunker in Figure 29 contained in the print and ebook editions of this book, was one of these early gas chambers. The nature of later gas chambers is examined below. This is a good point at which to raise objections regarding lines of responsibility and authority in these operations. Huss says he received his order directly from Himmler during, we have agreed to pretend, the summer of 1942. This means that Himmler not only bypassed Glucks, but also Pohl in giving this order directly to the camp commandant, specifying that Glucks was not to learn what was going on. Himmler reached three levels or more down to give the order, and specified that Huss was to maintain an impossible secrecy. Most irregular. That is not all. The story we are offered by the Huss affidavit and testimony and all other sources is that, except for certain later developments to be discussed, the German government left the means of killing, and the materials required, a matter for the judgment and ingenuity of the local camp commandant. Huss decides to convert two old peasant houses. Huss found that Soclone kicking around the camp, and decided that it offered a more efficient method of solving the Jewish problem than that employed at Treblinka, where they had scrounged up some captured Russian tanks and trucks to use for exterminations. All of this is idiotic, and Reitlinger is obviously uncomfortable with the problem of the responsibility of the Soclone decision, but gets nowhere with the difficulty, except to make it graver by suggesting that Hitler finally decided on Soclone quote-unquote with misgiving.